All right, so we are on page 27, the importance of practice. Much of what you do comes from the ego. Let me define ego for you, since all words can have varying meanings. Ego is the belief in the false identity, I. So when I say that much of what you do comes from the ego, I mean you are being driven or moved by that belief in the mind. That is the same as saying you are listening to and believing thoughts or stories in the mind. And this is the belief in illusion. So I'll go a little bit into what you were just talking about, Francine. Probably not as deep, but a little bit into it. So what Inaramana is saying here is that when this body moves and when this body speaks, if my attention is on the I chatter in the mind, then what's moving the body and what's, you know, making the speaking happen is the belief in the separate self. You could call that the ego, but some people, when they think of the ego, I don't know exactly what they conjure. I almost think they're imagining like it's some kind of a character, you know, when really it's the belief in the I thought that's causing the movement, because your attention is with the I thought. So let's make up an example. I'm going to use a made-up story about Francine. Just so everybody knows, it's totally made up. But Francine and I are friends. So let's imagine, and we share her daughter, Danielle. So let's imagine I say something to Danielle, not intending to hurt her, but Danielle gets hurt, and Danielle goes to Francine and says, Regina said this to me, right? And for some reason, Francine starts boiling, right? She gets so angry. So the next time she sees me, she's angry. Okay, first of all, her anger is coming from her belief in the I thought, right? The belief in the I thought, the belief in my daughter, you could say my side, right? But then if she's angry at me and she says something to me and I react back in a defensive way, my action is also coming from the I thought. If either Francine or I or both of us were not coming from the I thought at that time, if we were focused on mantra and focused on surrender, if our attention was placed in a different place, our actions, our movements, our words would also be different. Right? That's what this is saying. And what's interesting is he's saying much of what you do comes from the ego. So, and again, I'm the scribe, so I have to take responsibility here. He's telling me that I still have my attention cast upon I thought a lot, the belief in a me, and therefore that's what's moving this body, is that belief, rather than, you know, what many people would call being moved by spirit, but I'm just going to be called being moved by something else, something other than the belief in the I thought. So again, let me read these first couple of paragraphs. Much of what you do comes from the ego. Let me define ego for you, since all words can have varying meanings. Ego is the belief in the false identity I. So when I say that much of what you do comes from the ego, I mean that you are being driven or moved by that belief in the mind. That is the same as saying you are listening to and believing thoughts or stories in the mind. And this is belief in illusion. We've already agreed that our purpose now is not to believe the mind. This is what I call non-attachment. Non-attachment is not believing the mind. Sometimes, one thing that's really interesting to me about Inaramana is sometimes Inaramana will say something, shift the words a little bit, and then say the exact same thing again. You know, it's funny because it's such a simple little book. I remember one person came up to me and told me how they read the whole book in one day. And you can do that, right?
your eyes can blaze over.
But you're going to miss a whole lot of stuff. Yeah. And it's almost like Inner Brahmana knows we're going to miss this stuff if it's said just once. So it's repeated, right? So we've already agreed that our purpose now is not to believe the mind. This is what I call non-attachment. Non-attachment is not believing the mind. And then complete non-attachment is realization. And one of the things that maybe I haven't shared yet on these audios that I have shared with my MPP classes is in this book, The Teachings of Inner Brahmana, when it refers to realization or self-realization, that's not the same as awakening. Now, in general non-duality language, self-realization means the end of the ego or the ego death. But when Inner Brahmana spoke to me, first of all, I had no familiarity whatsoever with non-duality, you know. And so Inner Brahmana was just speaking to me and I was understanding the words in a certain way. And the way I understood the word realization was that I realize who I am and therefore that's who I'm listening to. So we could say self-realization would be the equivalent of listening to only one voice. But that doesn't mean the other voice isn't still there, whispering, right? So self-realization in the teachings of Inner Brahmana in this book alone is not the same as no ego. In this book, awakening means no ego, right? So that's when the ego has completely died. So what he's saying is complete non-attachment from mind is realization. When you are completely non-attached from the mind could be chattering away, but you have no interest in it and you're hooked into your intuition and you're listening to your intuition all the time. The reason you're doing that is because you realize who you are. You used to think you were the mind, right? And you listened to it, but now you realize you aren't, so you're listening to intuition because you realize that's your true voice. Okay, so we've already agreed that our purpose now is not to believe the mind. This is what I call non-attachment. Non-attachment is not believing the mind. Complete non-attachment is realization. So, if much of what you do comes from attachment or believing the mind, achieving non-attachment must come from doing differently. And this is the purpose of surrender. And again, if I get up in the daytime and I think about, okay, I got this and this and this and this to do, I think I'll do this first because, God, I don't want to do that other thing. I'm just going to put it off a little bit and I'm going to do this. And I'm choosing how I'm going to order my day that way. The I thought is in every bit of that, right? I'm reinforcing the I thought the whole time. I'm still being attached to mind. And so surrender is, again, a way of doing differently because we all have to do, right? I mean, when you, the life that you have to do. You can't sit in a cave and not do. There have been people in the history of the world, even people now, who can do that. But the lives that we have involve doing. So we have to be able to do differently, right? And that's the purpose of surrender, to allow us to do differently, and that way we can release the attachment to mind. So the top of page 28. When you ask me for guidance in the moment, you are giving willingness to detach from ego or belief in the false I and realize true self through non-attachment. To try to understand awakening while the false concept I is in place can be very frightening because as false I stretches beyond itself to understand what is being taught, it finds it is not there. To the one who defines himself by this false thought, absence of I appears as death. Okay, so he's talking about something that we all know, that the ego obviously fears the end of ego, right? And if we're really, really attached to ego, we think we fear the end of ego. Now the truth is who we are does not fear the end of ego, right? So when we think we fear the end of ego, we're just still believing we're the mind. We're still believing the mind's thoughts. So that means if we can detach from the mind, if we can detach from the mind's thoughts, then we'll no longer believe we're afraid of the end of ego. And then when grace comes, whenever that happens, to invite us to go through the eye of the needle, we can do that. Mind may kick and scream and kick and scream, but we have trained ourselves, I'm not the mind, right? And so we're able to listen to the intuition that's going to guide us through the end, to the eye of the needle, and we're able to go into that state that is called awakening. So, again, starting with the top of, not the top of page 28, but where it says to try to understand. To try to understand awakening while the false concept I is in place can be very frightening, because as false I stretches beyond itself to understand what is being taught, it finds it is not there. To one who defines himself by this false thought, the absence of I appears as death. Living without I is the answer to this fear. This is how true perception or guidance becomes a bridge. Some people want, I'm not going to go on quite to that yet. So again, what he is saying is as we practice surrender, as we practice the mantra, and instead of living with our thinking and figuring out, right, we're just asking, what am I to do now? What am I to do now? I am that I am. What am I to do now? We're breaking our attachment to mind, which means we're also breaking our attachment to fear. Think about that. You're breaking your attachment to fear. In fact, that might be more exciting to some people than the idea that you're breaking your attachment to mind. You're breaking your attachment to fear, because really all fear comes from the mind, just from the mind's chatter. All right, so next paragraph. Some people want to understand awakening before committing themselves fully to it. They want to ensure they can understand that awakening is safe and is not death. But I would ask these ones to ask themselves, who wants to understand awakening? If they make this inquiry, they may discover it is attachment to the false I that wants to feel safe. In this way, to continue to seek spiritual knowledge or understanding is to remain attached to the false concept I. So this is a phase that I think we all go through at some point on the spiritual journey. You know, where we want to know, you know, somehow we're going to be safe in awakening, you know. And of course, what Inner Ramana is saying is if you have that feeling, if you find that you're trying to figure that out, are you safe in awakening? You know, just ask the question, what is it that wants to understand awakening? What is it that wants to know if there's safety there? And if you learn to really look, you'll see it's just thought. It's nothing but thought. There's nothing but thought that wants to know that. You could ask, does the body want to know that? Well, the body's not asking any questions. It's not the body. You could ask, does awareness want to know that? Well, heck, awareness is just being. It's not asking any questions. The thing that wants to know is the mind. And so if I continue to try and understand awakening so that I can feel safe, that means I still think I'm the mind. And that's just what he wants us to see. Because the truth is, you can never understand awakening.
Right.
And at some point, you've got to drop it, right? And so he's just trying to get us to that point where we drop that part of the spiritual path. And at some point, everybody does drop it. At some point, somehow, everybody realizes, I can't understand it. I can only go towards it, but I can't understand it. So he's just helping us make that decision here. It is much better to use your time in the practice of the mantra and surrender. You will awaken faster through these practices than through asking questions about awakening. It is said that whenever anybody would ask Buddha a metaphysical question, he would not answer. He did not want to explain the metaphysics to people. But of course, if you talk to him about practice, you know, he would respond. So it seems like Buddha and Inner Ramana are thinking alike here. You know, Inner Ramana is saying, forget about trying to understand all that stuff. Practice is what's important. And at least the way Thich Nhat Hanh talks about Buddha, that's the way Buddha was it too. It's, you don't need to understand anything, you need to practice. The power that makes the universe turn is you. This is not a vain statement. This is merely absolute truth. The world and all that you experience, your universe of objects and relationships and reactions, comes from you. It comes from your belief in these experiences and your thoughts about them. So this is getting into the cast attention discussion that we had before we turned the recording on. You know, there's a belief that we have that I do things, right? I drove here tonight. I'm teaching a class right now. You know, I. That I that claims our actions and our words, that I is in thought only. It's not real. And if you come to see this, or even if you don't see it, but you just start to accept that it might be true, the next question that comes up is, well, if this I is not making me move and making me speak, what is? And sometimes people will just say, God. God is. But the truth of the matter is, and we went through this when we were in NTI, we went through this in NTI Ephesians, the truth of the matter is, what we really do, this is what Francine was talking about, what we really do is we cast attention. That's all that we are. We are awareness and we cast attention, because attention is really just an aspect of awareness, right? So we cast attention. And when we cast attention on something, something becomes manifest from that. Now, so if you take all of the billions of people in the universe, which are really all one awareness, you could say, but all of the billions of people in the universe casting attention on different thoughts, different beliefs, different ideas, all of that is causing the manifestation of the world, right? So everything in form, including the movement of this body and the speaking of these words, is the manifestation of where we cast our attention. That's what's happening here. And that's what Inner Ramana is saying. The power that makes the universe turn is you. This is not a vain statement. This is merely absolute truth. Now, the you here, sometimes where people get a little confused with these kinds of teachings is if I was to think that somehow I, Regina, this is still the I thought in action, I, Regina, am making Francine, and I, Regina, am making Dan, you know, that's a mistake. The you is back, you could say back further. The you makes, it makes Regina, it makes Francine, it makes Dan, and it's what we all are. So, of course, the you here is not the individual that we think we are. What we're being taught here is we are not what we think we are. We are not the I thought. The I thought is nothing but an idea in mind. So the power that makes the universe turn is you. This is not a vain statement. This is merely absolute truth. The world and all that you experience, your universe of objects and relationships and reactions, comes from you. It comes from your belief in these experiences and your thoughts about them. So we cast attention onto the world. We cast attention onto our thoughts about the world, and that's what makes the entire world. This is why, in brief, why the world fades from sight as you practice the mantra and surrender. The world comes from your attachment to your thoughts. As you detach from these thoughts, there is no more power to make a world. Jesus told you that you would begin to see light around objects, and this is the beginning of true vision. And Jesus tells us that in the workbook of A Course in Miracles. I tell you that the truth is one, and the appearance of objects occurs only because you believe the mind. And I did have one person ask me once, so is Inner Ramana saying Jesus is wrong? And no, that is not the way I understood it. I understood it as, again, you got to remember, I felt this was very personally talking to me. And I felt him say, it's basically like at an earlier time you learned this. Now you're ready to hear this, right? I didn't see him as correcting Jesus, just saying it. At an earlier time you learned that when you begin to see light around objects, that's the beginning of true vision. I'm telling you, the only reason you see any objects at all is simply because you're believing the mind. And this is kind of an important thing to tell Regina, because Regina used to... Depressed is a little too strong of a word. I've never actually suffered depression, but I'm going to use that word anyway. You know, Regina used to get a little depressed because she wasn't seeing light around objects. You know, because she read that in A Course in Miracles, she thought that somehow that would be the sign of spiritual advancement, and it wasn't happening for her. And so, you know, right? And so this is why this is being brought up. And he's saying the only reason you see any objects at all is because you believe the mind. So he's really trying to refocus me. Instead of, you know, worrying about the fact that you don't see light about around objects, why don't we just let go of listening to the mind completely? You know, let's just turn our attention into a different direction. By listening to me through surrender, you detach from your belief in objects and a world, and you allow them to fade. By practicing the mantra, you still the mind, and you are no longer adding to the power that creates the world of objects seen and experienced. So again, you know, as we cast attention on our thoughts, we write the script of the world. If we can instead surrender to just intuition and saying the mantra and not be caught up in all of that thinking, in some way, the world is going to begin to fade from view. The next one is fairly short. Should we go ahead and do it here? Is that okay? All right, the importance of practice, part two. Surrender is a practice I will continue to emphasize because it is one of the most helpful of all spiritual practices. One may argue that surrender is not the only path of awakening, but this is more of an emphasis than a truth. The only path of awakening is to deny the false, and the false must be denied completely. Surrender is a means of doing this while still moving about in the world. Without surrender, one may deny the world by withdrawing from it. This is also a path that has worked. So really, he's pointing out two possible paths, and I think we're all aware of these two possible paths. One is the possible path of meditating, you know, 12 hours a day, which people do, and they wake up from that. You know, some people do anyway. And the other is the path of it's what Ramana Maharshi used to call the householder. It's the path of still being active in the world, but learning to detach from the mind anyway through the use of other tools like self-inquiry, mantra, surrender. And so again, we're being told we have to learn to deny the false. Deny the false means the same as stop believing it. We have to learn to deny the false, whether we deny the false by, you know, sitting in a cave or a bedroom, you know, turning our attention away from thoughts when they show up in the mind, or whether we deny the false by moving about in the world, but turning our attention away from thoughts by being focused on the mantra of surrender, ultimately we're doing the same thing. Now, what would be excellent is if we could do that at least 12 hours a day. Right? I mean, the recommendation for meditation is meditate as much as possible, maybe 12 hours a day. But if we can't sit and meditate 12 hours a day, can we practice the mantra and surrender 12 hours a day, or even more, all of our waking hours?
It seems like since we started, it says it, I know in one part of it says it out loud, but I've been getting a sense that we started that this is a 24/7.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
It's the best way I can
describe
it. But and I guess I knew that, but it wasn't until we started doing this. It was like, there's no loopholes in it. and I heard before, and fatigue seems to be like my number one offender. Is like it's really I find it hard to drop into the heart.
Yeah.
Or when the fatigue sets in. So but I when they say it's an ongoing, it's this practice the mantra as often as you remember to practice it without being truthful to yourself. It's like, oh yeah, I should do it because I just remembered I should do it. But I can't really cite passages and things like that, but I know since we started, it's been like this is all the time.
I'll tell you what my mind sometimes says. Now obviously I ignore it because you see me sitting here teaching the teachings of Inner Ramana. But what my mind sometimes says to me while I'm teaching is something, I mean, it's just a quick thought, so it's not it's not lots of words, and I have to put it into words, but it says something like, come on, oh my God, Regina, how many times have you told this people to practice the surrender in order to break the attachment to mind? Come on, Regina, they know that already. You know, because since the beginning of this book, that's all that's being said, you know. You're breaking the attachment to mind. Practice, and he just keeps saying it, and he keeps saying it, and he keeps saying it. But why do you think he keeps saying it, and keeps saying it, and keeps saying it? Because it looks like we need to hear it that many times before we really, 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 really get what you're saying right now, you know. If we read one message, even though that one message may have told us, how many of us would do it? Yeah. So he just keeps saying the same thing over and over again, in slightly different ways. But there's nothing different in this entire book other than practice surrender, practice the mantra, and then in a little bit he's going to add another tool, self-inquiry. We'll have three. But he just wants us to live our entire life practicing these tools, and with all three of them available, he says you'll always have one that you can use to break your attachment. They all three do the same thing. They break your attachment to mind, right? And then you just use whichever one feels most appropriate in the moment. Yeah. And it is. It's like learning how to live in meditation.
Right. It seems I've been around long enough to know that there's something unique about being American. And while we're highly advanced, but we're not highly spiritually advanced. So ever since I've started this, I've known that as an American, I was an American Buddhist, and there's a true movement. There's American Buddhism. It's not a secondhand.
Oh my goodness! What do you think that was?
American Buddhism is the secondhand translation for getting something, and hopefully you can get some truth from it. It's like it has its roots in America, and most of it's returning to the breath. I'd say is like the most important thing, because like just driving from my house, not that far away, here's not so bad, but a lot of it's probably west, but you're bombarded, there's billboards, pretty much it's liquor, sex, and liquor, sex, and food,
liquor, sex, and food.
Well, it's hard to ignore it, because there's flashing lights. Yeah. And it's a neon. I clearly remember, liquor, all these things were like, I was bombarded. And the reason I noticed it is because I was driving from my house to go to satsang, and I was just trying to stay present. And then you look up, and it's like liquor, and the next one, and of course it's a mom in a bikini or something, and it's just meant to distracting us, as a distraction. So it's like American Buddhism is a practice of reminding yourself to constantly return, and it's not at all about meditating for 12 hours a day.
Yeah.
Most people, even like the teachers, I can't find anybody who would really disagree with like 45 minutes a day. After that, it's, you know, I mean, unless you're going on an extended retreat, but 25 minutes, anything less than 25 minutes won't really.
Yeah, right now I'm doing an hour. But then this practice then is very much like your what you're calling American Buddhism. It's about that constant.
Always remind yourself to come back. In Buddhism, it's a return to the breath, but then there's meditative self-inquiry, the mantra. The last couple of weeks we've been doing that a lot too. It's anything you can do to, because America, like I said, it's...
Stay out of that.
I'm not saying Americans have a... It's different. It's definitely different in this country.
Hmm. All right, good. All right, so we have the only path of awakening is to deny the faults, and the faults must be denied completely. Surrender is a means of doing this while still moving about in the world. Without surrender, one may deny the world by withdrawing from it. There's the setting in the cave. This is also a path that has worked. The enlightened person who realizes self while still experiencing a body does not experience independence. The belief in independence or the idea of ego has died for this one, or he would not be realized. So here he's using the word realized differently. There we go. So he switches. But again, if I still have any thought that I am doing things, that's the ego, right? That's the ego. And when the ego is gone, there is no belief in an I that is doing things. And so you would say there is no independence. Everything is connected, right? For lack of better words. In fact, the next paragraph. As there is no idea of independence, there is also no idea of deciding for himself. The enlightened one who lives in a fully realized state lives and acts, moves and speaks according to a script that is fed to him in the moment. The script comes from the one for the highest purposes of the one. So the enlightened person does not feel separate from the script maker, nor does he feel he is making decisions for himself. He follows in joy and realization. So this is just being moved. You know, in the Bible, Jesus called it being moved like the wind, you know. And Nisargadatta, what was it that Nisargadatta said about speaking? Someone said something like, I see you there, you know, sitting there and talking to me. You know, and Nisargadatta said something like, you don't think about your hair growing. You know, it just grows. Well, I don't think about my speaking. It just happens, right? And you know, how do you describe movement and speaking without the I thought? People think, thank you. Okay, he did go to class. That's good. People think that you need the I thought in order to speak and think. And they think if you don't have the I thought, you shouldn't be able to do anything. And in fact, I will tell you, a few weeks ago, I had an experience that I don't quite know what it was. It started in meditation, and then after meditation, for another hour to an hour and a half, it lasted. Same text. He's texting me again. I should turn this off. It's kind of hard to say. The thought of I that I usually think is moving this body, I was definitely not moving the body. I mean, that was being seen. The body was just being moved, and the mind was being asked by whatever was moving the body to surrender and to get out of the way and to allow it to happen. And so the mind was kind of funny. The mind actually reminded me of Shiloh. Now Shiloh is jumping and jumping, but at some point you can get her to just kind of lay there and pet her. And the mind reminded me of Shiloh at that point where it's starting to just really lay down, you know, and try and be good. But it was still active, but it was trying to really lay down and be very, very good and get out of the way and allow this other mysterious force to move the body without interference. But what I saw in the mind is that it was a little afraid, not terrified, a little concerned, maybe, that if it surrendered completely, that I, because it still had the I thought, that I would not be able to work out, would not be able to work, like that I would become a bumbling idiot if I let this thing, whatever it was, take over. So it was kind of interesting to watch because the mind was kind of, you know, for lack of better words, trying to be good, trying to surrender, trying to allow it. You could say the mind was aware of the desire for awakening, and so it was trying to surrender, but at the same time it just had this concern that practicality, practical movement, practical speaking would be lost because the mind has the belief, I need to do that. I'm the one that keeps everything under control. Right? And so I saw that, and then at some point the experience faded, and so I now am very aware that that belief is in me, that the mind is needed for control, because I was able to look at it. And so what this is telling us is that's not true. This is telling us that when the I thought is gone, the body moves and the body speaks perfectly, and that it's the totality of the universe that's taking care of it. And if you think about it, doesn't that make sense that the thing that can make your hair grow can also make this body move and speak, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and actually thinking actually trips you up.
Yeah.
If you're trying to achieve like excellence, I guess. Or, I mean, say in Pueblo, it's, excellence is a big thing, you know. It's this part of the country, but the wisdom tradition here is like they call it sobriety, they also call it excellence, impeccability, and if you trust in the loving presence and let go, you can achieve the excellence. And once you start thinking about it, and actually it slows you down, messes you up, and you start breaking, spilling, you know, dropping, falling, whatever, you know.
Yeah.
You don't have that spontaneous grace.
Yeah, very good. So yes. So the one who is enlightened is just moved, right? That you don't need an I thought to move and speak. So is it surrender when the enlightened one follows this script? Since there is no other, who would he surrender to? And yet it is following, just as surrender contains the idea to follow. What he's really trying to express here is there is no I. You know, there is no I thought. You know, you every now and then hear people say things like, you know, once you're enlightened, you can manifest whatever you desire. You know, but there's no I, you know. and so he's really making the point, but that I that would desire and then then decide to manifest, it doesn't exist. You will see a body, and you will see that body speaking, and you, because you have an I thought, you will think that one has an I as well. But that is just not the case, right? It's just not the case. That's just spontaneous movement that you are seeing happening there. And spontaneous speaking.
It's good stuff. It annihilates a lot of what has come before. Like, you know, that example you gave. But I mean, I can think of one that came to me last week, and that's like, I can never make a statement. I've had an awakening experience, because that would still be a person alive making that statement.
Yeah.
It's like I kind of gave up on enlightenment and awakening, because I know that I'll never be able to make that statement. I'm alive or I'm awake. Because if I did, there'd still be some remnant. The individual I who has ownership of that quality.
Yeah. Well, you know, I am not awakened, but it's funny because you know, over and over for the last 4 or 5 years of my life, there have been people who show up who either ask me why I don't say that I'm awakened, like they think that I am, and they want to know why I don't say that. And the answer is because there's still an I here. That's the answer. You know, there's still an I here. And I, you know, everything that I read, that I trust, very clearly points that there will not be an I. And so, I mean, I tell people that I'm very much purified, you know, compared to what I once was. I have a lot more clarity than I once did, and you know, and that's all good, you know, and I'm much happier, real true happiness.
Yeah.
But I'm not awake, and I know I'm not awake because the I is still there.
So a lot to be said for contentment, fulfillment, clarity.
Sure.
You know, I always thought that you know, like enlightenment was about, you know, the highest you can set the bar, but now I'm like so much more willing to accept, you know, contentment, you know. For so many people are like, I'm stuck. I'm like truly content, truly, you know, fulfilled in the true sense of the word. All these, you know, like very, very authentic. That's just like,
yeah.
You know, I have my needs, so I'm now content.
Yeah.
So, you know, awakening and it's not like self-realization, but enlightenment and awakening are kind of like they're falling away for some reason. And I'm going for like more.
Well, you know, it's funny. I have, you know, maybe you could say, for lack of better words, 3 goals, which maybe don't even sound like they go together, but for me they go together perfectly. One is to be happy now. Be happy now. The other is to have intense desire, if you will, for awakening and to demonstrate that desire through vigilant practice. And then the other is not to be concerned whether I awaken or not. All 3 at the same time. You know, and some people may say those don't go together, but actually they go together quite well. They have some kind of a balance in them that is really perfect.
Thank you. I've been talking for a long time.
And it's hard to explain that to people, but if you're there, if you've found how to be in all 3 at once, then you know. You know that you can do it, and maybe it's like a 3-legged stool. If you have a 3-legged stool and you cut one leg off, the stool falls over, right? So maybe in a way you need to find all 3 of those: the be happy now, the intense desire for awakening, and then but it's okay if, you know, the not caring whether you awaken or not, because you can't have that sense of lack in it, right? And yet you can't quit. If you quit, the ego will regain any foothold that you allow it to. And then you won't be happy now. I mean, you know, so it all goes together perfectly. All right, so I'll go back to the is it surrender. Is it surrender when the enlightened one follows this script? Since there is no other, who would he surrender to? And yet it is following, just as surrender contains the idea to follow. Some would call this script karma, and others use the term script. But whenever there is a feeling of victim associated with the idea, karma is established or the script is written. One has not yet realized the maker of the script. So again, if there's any idea of victimhood at all, obviously there's still an I there. I mean, who else would feel like a victim? You know, right? So there's no awakening there. And it's a little sad. You know, I don't know, maybe it's always been popular, but it's a little sad how popular it is for people to claim awakening when there's still very much an I present. Because what happens when you claim awakening and you are not awakened, well, you always suffer, but you're going to suffer now in a different way. You're going to suffer from not being able to meet your own expectations of yourself, right? You know, at some point, it's really going to be quite painful. It's much easier to be honest. Then when you make a mistake, you can say, oops, I made a mistake. Told you I wasn't awake. You know, see, the ego came. I told you it was still there. There it just showed its ugly head. Proof. Okay. This is also why the questions of free will and destiny seem to conflict when looked at through the human psyche. The human psyche cannot understand the compatibility of destiny and free will, because the human psyche sees itself as independent and has not realized the greater truth of self. So some people think that either you have free will or it's a script, but it can't be both. But in truth, it is both.
It is both, yes.
Yeah, it is your free will that writes the script. You know, your free will, we could say, of where you cast your attention, right? So and someone would call that the free will of choice. But it is the free will that writes the script. So it's completely intertwined. You cannot separate the two. But it's very difficult for the human mind to think about. The human mind wants it to be one or the other. But it is both. Yeah, both. You are not separate from the script maker. This is the absolute truth I shared with you yesterday. But as long as your mind believes the thought of independence, the false concept I, this is a point you will easily become confused on. Therefore, it is a point I ask you not to think about, but merely trust. So he's going into a tiny bit of metaphysics here, you could say. What he's trying to explain is that we don't need the I thought in order to move. Movement happens anyway. And in fact, the I thought is just causing us to continue to believe that we're independent, and that's the only thing that it really does. All of the movement that's necessary for the body is going to continue to happen whether there's an I thought or not. So he's explaining this to us, but then he's saying, don't think about this too much. Because if he encouraged us to think about it, he'd be sending us right back into thinking, which is what he's trying to guide us away from. So he's just giving us just enough information so that if we have this thought that I described, I found in me, which we probably do have this thought, if we have this thought, I need the mind in order to be practical, in order to make sense. He wants to give us just enough teaching so that maybe we can trust, maybe I don't need the mind to be practical. Maybe I can let go of the mind and practicality will still happen. I can still care for my children. I can still go to my job. He just wants us to trust this little bit of teaching enough so that we're willing to let go of mind. He doesn't want us to think about it and try to understand it and all of that. And, he says, I ask also, since you cannot understand how you make a script, that you refrain from script making by quieting the mind and living or acting based upon surrender. So again, don't try to get all full of understanding about how giving your attention to thought writes the script. Instead, just refrain from it by returning to these simple practices, the mantra and surrender. That's really the only reason this teaching occurred, was to increase our willingness to practice the mantra and surrender. If you follow the practice of mantra and surrender and refrain from thinking for yourself, you also refrain from making a script that includes a false concept self. Since this self is only part of a script and not part of reality, ceasing to make it also allows it as an idea to fade. This is part of awakening, because this is non-attachment to a false I. Non-attachment to the false lays the way, opens the sky to allow realization of the truth. So that's it. Again, nothing different, just keep practicing the mantra, keep surrendering. But if we wanted to add something additional, it would be go ahead and allow yourself a silent trust that I is not needed. Right? That I is not needed. Just allow yourself to kind of let that trust arise and just kind of hang around. Let it marinate. How's that? Let it marinate in your mind this week. That I is not needed. Cooking can still happen. Driving can still happen. Recognizing children and talking to children can still happen. And, you know, I don't need this I.
Awakening won't make you a bad parent.
Awakening.
But I know people that are scared, full of fear, that if they, you know, will I be a good parent? Will I still be a good parent?
Yes.
Put it that way. I've seen a lot of fear when it comes to taking that last, last few steps.
Yeah, well, that's what I experienced when I had that experience. Again, not a lot of fear because the mind was trying to be like Shiloh-like, very, very good, you know, but it was definitely there, the concern that, oh God, if I go all the way here, then what? You know, I mean, then I'm not going to be able to do anything practical anymore. So, so it's in there. I saw it. I know it's there. And so this week we'll just trust. And I'll go ahead and stop this recording.